I'm guessing a fair number of you may have only fleeting familiarity with pharmacies' involvement in immunization services, so that is doubly helpful for us in pharmacy to be able to talk with you about that some more. I'd like to recognize my co-author, Suntri Wachiranamangrangkun, who is in the audience, and also my colleague, Dr. Salisa Westrick from Auburn University, who's been involved in this project. Also like to thank CDC, the Public Health Law Program, actually was the funding agency for this particular project. So by way of background, for those of you who aren't terribly familiar with pharmacy involvement in immunization services, it seems like this is a pretty important starting point. The fact of the matter is that pharmacy in different parts of the country have been involved in immunization delivery. We're now talking about community pharmacies, particularly the sort where you would walk into a pharmacy with a prescription order and ask to have it filled. So this would be any kind of chain pharmacy, independent community pharmacies, and so on. For about 30, 35 years, some states have permitted pharmacists to be involved directly in immunization delivery, actually doing the immunization administration, the vaccine administration. Over the recent about 15 to 20 years, essentially every state, I think we now have only two states that still have laws in place that prohibit pharmacists from doing immunization vaccine administration, but all of the other states do now permit this. We've had two national studies that were done looking at the extent to which pharmacists were involved in these activities. As you can see, a decade ago, we were at about 1 in 50 pharmacies actually was involved in some respect, predominantly with adult immunization in a very limited way and childhood immunization. By 2001, this had grown somewhat, but still relatively modest numbers. And again, you see this differential between adult and childhood vaccines. The fact is that even now, pharmacies are not terribly involved in childhood immunization, feeling that the medical home for the child is particularly important. So most of the activity in the community pharmacies has been really in adult immunization delivery. Pharmacists play quite a wide array of roles in with respect to immunization. Most of them are involved in some way in promotional activities, educational activities, trying to encourage all patients to be immunized, properly immunized. Some of them are involved more heavily in facilitating immunization delivery with a kind of flu clinics and so on that probably happen in many of your communities. And what we're talking about today really is the most extensive involvement or intensive involvement, which is when pharmacists themselves are trained as immunizers and offer immunization services directly in their pharmacies. We're focusing today on flu vaccine administration because as we look at the data that we have from our study, about 50% of the community pharmacies involved in immunization delivery actually are handling flu vaccine only. Slightly less than half are handling multiple vaccines, but about half of them are specifically restrict their activity to flu. In that respect, it's a very important kind of a gateway, if you will, toward more extensive immunization activities. So if pharmacists can figure out how to do flu vaccine, then the chances are much greater, from what we understand, for them to become involved in pneumococcal, hepatitis, other kinds of important vaccines, particularly for the adult population. So we know a fair amount about this being an area of increasing activity, but what we know precious little about, unfortunately, is what it is that helps make this successful in the community pharmacies, and that's what I'd like to spend some time talking with you today about. And really, the objective is pretty simple, which is to look at the pharmacy characteristics that help us to predict success of pharmacy-based immunization delivery programs. I think there are some things we can learn and maybe things that can help you as you return to your home communities or work at your state level to try to facilitate expansion of pharmacy involvement in this area. Indeed, as our title for today says, we are talking about increasing the capacity for vaccine delivery, and this is, I think, an important avenue. The unit of analysis we're looking at are community pharmacies. Again, for those of you who are not embedded in this area, there are about 60,000 community pharmacies in the United States, geographically widely distributed with secure cold chain distribution, deliveries usually once, twice per day, every weekday, most weekend days as well. So the facilities for distributional activities are really quite strong, very secure, highly reliable. And so this is one of the reasons we feel like this is an important group to get a better understanding of and encourage their involvement. The study that I'm reporting on, we looked at 17 states located around the United States. I can show you real quickly a little map, and then we can come back. The states in yellow are the states that were involved in this study. So you can see they're relatively geographically dispersed. They are clustered pretty deliberately because it turns out that even in those clusters, there's wide variability in what the state laws are with respect to pharmacist involvement in immunization delivery. So we are looking at 17 states. We sampled 150 community pharmacies in each of the states. We ended up with 69% of the pharmacies we sampled actually participating in the study. Of those 1,707 pharmacies that we were able to study, a total of 301 of them, or approximately 1 in 6, was actually involved in what we refer to as in-house immunization delivery. That is where a pharmacist in the pharmacy is actively administering immunizations of some sort. Again, most of this is about half the pharmacies are restricted to flu vaccine. About half of them reach beyond this to involve a wider array. We did telephone interviewing with each of these pharmacies. The interviews were, some were very brief if they weren't involved in the area, just a couple minutes. Some of them, where they were highly involved, would have reached 30, 40 minutes to try to gather all of the information. Our data collection period is an important thing for you to recognize here. It was July of 05 to February of 06. So what we are reporting on is actually flu vaccine administration in the 2004-2005 year, which many of you lived through that and know that that was one of the really severe shortage years, the year of the Chiron problems. I'll be actually addressing that because it influences our findings in some very important ways. We've done a lot of looking at who responded to this particular survey, and not surprisingly find that the ones that we had greater difficulty contacting were less likely to be involved in immunization delivery, but I guess that's probably not a surprise. Again, just as a reminder, this is where we were conducting our study. The state variability is not just geographic, but as I mentioned, intended to capture something of the variability across the United States with respect to what pharmacists are permitted to do under the varying state pharmacy practice acts and health acts and medical practice acts that actually govern immunization delivery. So what we wanted to do is look at factors that kind of characterize the pharmacies and get an understanding of where were activities greater what kinds of things, what might we look to as far as strategies for trying to enhance, to expand the involvement of pharmacies in immunization delivery. So what I will be reporting on are the 301 pharmacies that specifically are already involved in immunization delivery. And the question that we want to look at comes in kind of two flavors. One of them is the question of flu vaccine doses that they ordered. How many doses of the vaccine did they actually order? And as you'll see, this looks almost identical, but the dependent variable here is the number of flu vaccine doses administered. And again, the reason for the separation here is because this was in an extreme shortage year, and so what they ordered would have been what the pharmacy would have expected to be administering during a typical year. What they actually administered was reflective of the supplies that they received and due to the shortages. So thinking about factors we're interested in looking at, pharmacy characteristics that we settled on looking at had to do with the pharmacist staffing, the number of pharmacists in the pharmacy, which is basically an indicator of how large the pharmacy is. More pharmacists indicates more patients, larger volume of prescriptions and patients going through the pharmacy. We included in here something we refer to as school of pharmacy affiliation. About 40% of all pharmacies in the United States are affiliated in some way, shape, or form with a school or a college of pharmacy, working as training sites or having pharmacists who serve as clinical instructors and the like. So this is something that the schools have been advocating very strongly for the pharmacies to be more involved in public health activities, particularly in the immunization area. So we wanted to see if we could capture that. Workload, we were looking at basically busyness as a sort of a barrier, a potential barrier for pharmacists to become more involved in immunization delivery. If they already were sort of at peak workload, taking on something additional might be prohibitively difficult. The middle block of variables that we've titled service involvement, though, really are kind of core features of an immunization program in a pharmacy. Pharmacists are generally trained anywhere from 12 to 20 hours of specialty training on how to immunize vaccines, characteristics, vaccination schedules, and so on to become involved in immunization delivery. Some pharmacies carry many, many vaccines. Some of them, they may be for administration. They also may be simply for distribution to clinics or other local health groups. As I said, many are involved in promotion of immunization activities, and we thought that this is something that might actually prompt them to become more actively immunizing, be more successful in their immunization programs. Some of them offer services on a seasonal-only basis. Others of them offer immunization services on a year-round basis. And not surprisingly, this is going to be connected to whether they work with flu vaccine only or whether they have more extended array of vaccines that they're involved in carrying. Something that consumers recognize is that some pharmacies you can simply walk in and at any time of the day that the pharmacy is open say, I would like to, you know, receive a flu shot, and they say, step right up, we'll take care of you right now. Others, it's a matter that it may be that you need to make an appointment to have this done. Most pharmacies use both systems. You can make an appointment if you choose to, or you may simply do this on a walk-in basis. So we wanted to see whether that made a difference. Turns out that ends up not being something terribly important, but wanted to at least recognize that this is something that you see as a variability, as somewhat variable across pharmacies in the community sector. So again, we want to look at not just the doses, flu vaccine doses ordered, but also the number administered, which is, I think, of greater interest to this group. So what did we find? I think what I'm going to try to do is simply, for those of you who like numbers, I'm not an economist, so I don't need to put up a really complicated table. I'm a sociologist, so I get to put up one of these kind of things, which is maybe even worse. So let me try to interpret this a little bit. What you see, if you look at the flu vaccine doses ordered, you see three arrows that actually go to that box over on the right. One of them comes from the very bottom, service schedule. And what this basically says is the interpretation for this is if you are an immunizer working on a year-round basis, you are going to administer more doses of flu vaccine in a given year. Now, flu vaccine is a seasonal thing, so the question is, why would it be that having year-round services would be advantageous? Why would it be beneficial? And the answer is, I think it's because the pharmacies become recognized as immunizers. They think about themselves that way. They're involved in outside the flu season. They're involved with pneumococcal. They're involved with hepatitis. They're involved with meningococcal. They're involved with other vaccines. And they start to be thinking of themselves more in this category of being an immunizing pharmacy. I think the consumers also begin to understand them more clearly in that way. So if we wanted to have more success in the community pharmacies as community pharmacy immunization programs, one of the things to do is to encourage them to reach out beyond delivery of flu vaccine only. It will help them become more successful even in the flu vaccine season. You see also a number, a line there from number of trained pharmacists to flu vaccine doses ordered. And in fact, what that's saying is the more pharmacists that you have in your site who you train to do immunization delivery, surprise, surprise, the more flu vaccine doses you're actually likely to, in this case, order. But we'll see that this also holds up with administration as well. The other thing you see is an arrow way at the top, which says the number of full-time pharmacists actually predicts ordering of more flu vaccine doses. And basically what this is saying is that if you are a large pharmacy, the larger you are, the more doses you would have requested for your pharmacy. That probably doesn't make any, that's not a surprise either. Large pharmacies would anticipate more patients coming through their doors. What you don't see is that are lines between the number of vaccines carried and promotion, that the pharmacies that carry more vaccines do not necessarily see themselves being more actively involved in flu vaccine administration, nor do the pharmacies that are more actively involved in promotion end up being more involved in flu vaccine dose ordering. And again, this will hold up when we look at administration. So just because a pharmacy is involved in some aspect of immunization activity does not guarantee it's going to be involved, more involved in all areas. So I think this is something, again, for us to try to get a little bit better handle on and sort out. When we actually look at flu vaccine doses administered, what we see is that in this shortage year, it looks like the number of flu vaccine doses actually delivered to the pharmacies was sort of random. Larger pharmacies did not necessarily receive more doses. It was hit or miss in the community pharmacies, the same as it was in many of your local health departments and state immunization programs. So it turns out that kind of goes away. But again, what we do see is that there are certain service arrangements that actually can help pharmacies be more successful. And these become recommendations then that we'll return to back when as we talk with the pharmacy audiences about this. On average, I should have mentioned this, on average, a typical community pharmacy in this particular study, there were 301 of them 301 pharmacies involved in this particular study. The average pharmacy ordered approximately 662 flu vaccine doses. Again, compared to some of your public health agencies, that's kind of a small number, but again, think about this, if we could reach 60,000 pharmacies, it would be a pretty big number. The average number of doses actually delivered to these pharmacies and administered by them was in the order of, if I can get my number here, 457, I believe. So you can see there was a fair amount of slippage. They lost about a third of their supply in the shortage year. So what do we see? We see that having more pharmacists involved in this activity is something that in a normal year we think would actually promote greater involvement and greater success of flu vaccine delivery administration to patients through community pharmacies. Affiliation with the School of Pharmacy was helpful in some regards, although only indirectly with respect to thinking about how many flu vaccine doses made it into patients. The success of the programs, though, really seemed to have important predictors from the way that the pharmacies chose to organize their services, the kinds of vaccines that extent to which they had their pharmacists trained and ready to do this, the extent to which they thought about the pharmacy as a place for a broader array of vaccines to be administered to patients and hence carried activity on a year-round basis. The findings we have basically correspond to the studies that have been done that have said that pharmacists who are educated, who are trained in immunization, are the ones who are the most likely to provide immunization. This training, interestingly, formal training, is not required in all states around the United States. It's required in most of them. It's not required in all of them. Most pharmacy students receive formal training in this area, but some of the practitioners who have been in their sites for a longer period of time may feel that they simply can do this without additional qualification. That's a rare occurrence, but it's permissible under some state laws. So when we think about strategy then for thinking about how to expand what pharmacists are able to contribute in this goal of increasing capacity for vaccine delivery, one of the things that we see is that they can, increase their size. They can be more successful, reach more people. They can affiliate with a school of pharmacy, and they can have appropriate workload for pharmacy personnel. Again, if they're stretched too thinly, they will be less likely to take on these activities. But more importantly, we can think about how to recommend service arrangements be placed into the pharmacy. Training pharmacists, having activity on a year-round basis. Expanding the scope of vaccines carried is a way to facilitate that, and increasing promotion might ultimately have some additional beneficial effects. When we think about how to practically suggest this, one thing that we say is think about having at least one vaccine that is not connected specifically to the flu season, one vaccine that is a year-round vaccine, and that may be enough. That in itself may be enough to kick them into a higher level of success in flu vaccine work. We have worked hard to try to gather data that would be largely reflective of the United States. We can't say that this is completely generalizable, though, so we need to at least recognize the limitation here. Our 17 states, because they are represented, the pharmacies are representative of their states, they're actually, this generalizes to about 28,000 of the community pharmacies in the United States, but obviously not to all of them. The other thing is we were looking at specific kinds of pharmacies, community pharmacies that you would traditionally be familiar with, but it's a matter that other pharmacies do exist and might have very different kinds of activities and successes. We'd like to thank the UW-Madison Survey Research Center, which actually collected these data, making up to 30 phone calls to individual pharmacies to gather data from them. Be glad you were not in the calling pool for this one. And again, to recognize the Public Health Law Program for their support. With that, I think I will close and we can entertain some questions.
Thank you, and as I see people doing, I hope if you have a question, please do line up at the microphone, even if you have a very loud speaking voice, because we're recording the session and the recording will not be able to pick up the question if you don't ask it in the microphone. And if you can just briefly introduce yourself and give your affiliation, that would be great. Thank you.
I'm Carolyn Cook. I'm the immunization nurse for Mary Rich Children's Hospital in Tacoma, Washington, and I actually have something for each of you. And thank you for increasing the nervousness of standing up here at a microphone by telling me I'm being recorded. So more people than this are listening to me. Jason, for you, I am from Washington State, and I'm an end user of the VIMBIP system. And, you know, there were a lot of kind of bugs to work out, but during the last year, I think the hugest problem was not how long the delivery was, but the variability of the delivery system, so that that made it very difficult to plan, because I, as opposed to what you had up there, have received vaccines in as soon as 2 days and as long as 6 weeks. So that was the biggest issue for the end user. And if I order too much, if it comes too soon, I don't have enough room in my refrigerator. And luckily, I'm associated with a hospital system, so I can take my extra to the pharmacy and they can store it for me. But it has promoted much more exchange of vaccines from clinic to clinic than we ever had before when we came in. And we have worked it out so that we have very, very few times when we have zero vaccines, but a lot of that has to do with coordinating with our local health department in terms of being able to say this person has more vaccine and this person needs vaccine, and being able to locally kind of solve that problem. So it still does involve the local health department quite a bit. So that's just a comment for you. And for you, Janine, I, as a nurse who gives vaccine and a nurse who's worked in the hospital and has great respect for pharmacies and pharmacists, I have some concerns in terms of speaking with the pharmacists locally that give vaccines. And some of my concerns are, I was shocked when you said there were states that had no requirement for further education. And the fact that pharmacists are not clinically trained, in that they're not trained to deal with patients. They're more, you know, they're different. And they are trained in some ways in terms of education. But the pharmacists that I talked to in my area of Washington were not doing some very simple things that were included in the standards of immunization practice, like screening people for contraindications to things and having someone in that area who was trained in advanced life support, because as we all know, there are people who do have anaphylactic reactions. And so those were my concerns. Can you talk a little bit about those? Because I think they do affect monetary things, because this is a lot more time consuming if you're doing screening questionnaires, making sure that you give people a handheld record, that you're giving them time to ask questions of you, and that you are going to extra training to make sure, and to make sure that you have standing orders from physicians to take care of emergencies?
Those are good questions. Washington State is an interesting case because of the fact that it was an interpretation of the law in the state that simply said there is nothing that prohibits pharmacists from doing immunization delivery or any other kind of injections, as a matter of fact. And as a result, there was no change in the law that was necessary in Washington State for this to initiate, and that was 35 years ago. So pharmacists in the state have been being trained, actually, in their formal programs, how to do immunization delivery, but there's nothing additional in the law that requires something beyond. Now, that's not true in most of the states, and in fact, most of the states, even where additional training is not required, the pharmacists usually do this. There are very well-known training programs that are offered. I just came from the American Pharmacists Association meeting this past week, and yet another massive cohort of pharmacists was being trained in I think the program there is a 16-hour program, how to do immunization delivery. And it was followed up by a train-the-trainer session in using the standard materials that the American Pharmacists Association distributes and is the what is recognized as the official training program, if you will, in about 20 of the states. So the people who have written that, Steve Foster, who often is at this meeting, is the pharmacy representative to ACIP, and he's the primary author of those materials. So the intent is for the pharmacy community to know as much as available for the routine practices. Again, they typically will screen out not work with high-risk patients, again, children, pregnant women. Many of them, they just will say, you need to see your primary provider. It's not something that we handle here. You need to. On the other hand, routine immunizations, I think the sense is that, what the research shows is that the people who find their way into community pharmacies for immunization delivery are typically a different population from the ones who find their way into public health departments or into their local clinics. That this really taps, especially for flu vaccine administration, really taps a very different group of the portion of the population who previously would not have been immunized. Ones lacking primary care providers is one of the biggest areas. So there are pluses and minuses. The programs that we're offering, most of the schools and colleges of pharmacy require students to be well trained in this. Again, typically doing a 15 to 20 hour program in this area. And they are required to have standing orders for both for the vaccine administration as well as for any emergency procedures. So all of this, almost every state requires a protocol with a local physician, some using medical directors from local health departments. So they try to make certain that the same standard of care is being provided, and that where there are more serious concerns, that it's a matter that those patients are redirected to more appropriate providers. So it's a mixed story.
Hi, Allie Kemp from the University of Colorado. I had a question for Janine. One of the challenges of involving pharmacies more in terms of collaborative immunization efforts is our record scatter, potential for record scatter, and also the difficulty practitioners have in terms of planning how much flu vaccine to order each year and potentially losing a lot of money. Did you question or did you have as part of this survey any information about communication with providers, informing them about immunizations that you gave and sort of planning efforts?
We didn't ask specifically about the informing, but again, part of the standard training and we're a project we're doing right now that's an intervention project. Part of the protocol is that the primary care provider always be notified. So it's a matter that this typically is done through written notification that's faxed to the primary care provider, assuming that the patient has a primary provider. Lacking that, then again, the materials may not go to any other provider. On the other hand, pharmacists, when they are going through training, for example, in my state, in Wisconsin, they're trained in use of the immunization registry. Apparently, mastery of the immunization registry in my state is a relatively complicated thing, which they said, I have a colleague who teaches all of these courses, and she said that really to master how to enter materials into the immunization registry is about a 6-hour training in itself from what her experiences are. So there's, as you can imagine, somewhat of a reluctance to get very involved in that. On the other hand, when we think about flu vaccine administration being what 50% of the pharmacies are handling, I don't know that most people have that information find its way into a vaccine, an immunization registry under other circumstances. So again, we try to make certain that they know what everybody else knows and needs to know and to be able to do. But it's a big community, so, and it's evolving.
Herb Young with the American Academy of Family Physicians, and I guess I'm sort of pursuing the same concept. Thank you for acknowledging the importance of the medical home in child health care, but the concept is really broadly. The American College of Physicians, the American Academy of Family Physicians, American Academy of Pediatrics, American Osteopathic Association all have signed on to a statement as to the importance of the medical home for all age groups. And so what would you suggest we pursue in terms of the interaction between medical homes and pharmacies until we do get registry systems that can, you know, work well? And I ask that particularly because you're saying it looks like the direction pharmacies need to take is to add at least another vaccine or two, which will have impact on flu, but also will get us into clearly other issues for making sure the medical home knows what's going on for chronic disease management, for example.
I'm not sure exactly. I mean, I think one of the, if I can be really direct, I think one of the things that can be done is to view pharmacists as partners rather than as competitors, less than capable of doing what it is that they're doing. I mean, our students now are, and again, this is where every graduate in the United States coming out of a pharmacy school, and this has been true for quite some time now, is going through, you know, at least a full year of clinical rotations as part of their program. The people who are doing this, large portions of them are going through postgraduate residencies as part of their training. Pharmacy education and pharmacy practice has gone through an enormous transition over the recent years, which I think a lot of people are really not very familiar with. And this is just one aspect of it. But again, I think one thing, too, is to recognize only in very limited situations do pharmacists have independent authority to immunize. This is done with partnership, in partnership with physicians in local communities, trying to expand the ability of a system that is, you know, especially in the seasonal, with the seasonal demand for flu vaccine, seeming to be pushed to the limit, independent of the children coming on board, and being able to say who else can help with this to reach populations that previously had not been as engaged in the system. So I think that, you know, I think there's plenty of work to go around. There's plenty of work to go around in this area. And the pharmacists are looking to partner. One of the barriers that they run into is that they cannot find a physician who is willing to partner with them. And that physician is actually the person who has greatest capacity to shape what it is that happens in the pharmacy.
So dialogue, it sounds like, at the local level between the equivalent organizations might be useful. Most, in our case, we have state chapters, and I don't know the structure of the other physician specialties.
It's interesting. I mean, we actually had a poster earlier in the assume it's still up downstairs. But the poster was talking about support from various groups in the local environments, the pharmacy community, the local public health and physician community, and it turns out that the pharmacy people are. At the national level and at the state level, the pharmacy people are so consistent in saying pharmacists should be more involved in public health activities, particularly in this area, that it's like white noise. No one hears it anymore. It's taken as a given. What makes a difference in whether a pharmacist or a pharmacy become involved in these activities has much more to do with the sense of whether their immediate pharmacist colleagues are supportive of it, and critically, whether the local public health community and the local physician community reaches out and says, this is something we think is good, rather than serving as a barrier that they kind of say, you're somebody else who can help, especially in managing the demands that occur during the flu season, that's something that's helpful. So It really is at that local level. Pharmacy has been saying, do it, do it, do it. And again, I think it's gotten to the point of white noise. It's really about the people in the local environment being able to help shape how this happens. And again, I think those physicians who are the people who sign the protocols, the collaborative practice agreements, or whatever they happen to be called in your particular area, those people have incredible influence in being able to help shape things, communication mechanisms, emergency response activities, all of that. And the pharmacists are interested in hearing that. They would like to have the guidance, and they would like to be part of the system, because they feel that this is something, as they're working with patients, especially chronic disease patients who see them, their pharmacists, every month, this is something that they may have a window to help with, that the patient might not be seeing the primary provider, might not be visiting the medical home during that time.
I'm Grace Aaron, I'm from Bethesda. My question is, especially about Pneumovax, is there any plan? You know, there are those little pocket size immunization records. Is there any plan for them to give them? Because most of these elderly think Pneumovax is yearly like the flu. And even some physicians even think it's every 5 years. And these elderly will go there and ask for it. Is there any plan, since the pharmacies are doing this, to give them something to show that they have had it and they don't need to have it every year? It becomes very frustrating for me. I work in an institution that we kind of control, but the elderly that are alive, we have this called something plus. That means they can go to Medicare, but then they can still come back to us. And then when they come, they will say, well, I had it last year, but they didn't give me anything. So with no record, it's just so difficult. But this little pocket size is so small, it's like a wallet size. If the pharmacy can do something, I think it will really help.
Many of them use that. The training programs for pharmacists all will heavily, heavily promote using the CDC's, the resource materials on the CDC website, National Immunization Coalition information. So it's a matter that if these materials are available, they are usually very interested in using them. And if it's a matter that you're coming across someone who is not using them, then I would simply say, if you know there's a particular issue, let the pharmacy know and tell them they should be. I mean, they're using the standard vaccine information sheets and those kind of things that are required. And they themselves will retain records of administration, because these are handled the same way that a prescription would be, so that the record is there and it's an intact record that it's been administered in a given pharmacy. But again, patients don't necessarily see the same pharmacy on an ongoing basis, which is one of the reasons that informing the primary care provider is such an important thing, to make certain that information trails with the patient as well. So I'm not sure there's a perfect answer to this, but if you come across situations where you see something that's just not exactly right, many of you are so heavily involved in this area that it's a situation where simply giving them a heads up and saying, you know, if you did this, it would make a lot better for everybody around, they usually will be all ears and say, you know, thank you. Can you help me figure out how to do that? They're very generally very receptive to this, because they want their patients to get the right care.